You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and I have slightly lost my voice as a result of 20 plus hours of comparing and two sets at Glastonbury Festival. I didn't even go out and go hard and enjoy myself, and I was in bed by 2 o'clock in the morning every night, which at Glastonbury terms is very reasonable. More exciting stuff, including Boutros's first gig to come. I will tell you all about that in the postamble. But now I am so pleased to finally have had Alison Spittle on this show. She is such a wonderful guest, such a tremendous comedian, and we are going to talk about her Edinburgh show Wet and why it's no longer simply about a fight during an acro aerobics class. And we're going to talk about, I'm going to content warning this in a sort of general way, because some horrible shitty things have happened to Alison and she's managed to make excellent comedy out of them. We are going to get into them in some depth, and we're going to talk specifically about the challenge of keeping oneself emotionally secure when you're making comedy out of pain. She is such a powerful comic and such a powerful person, and I'm so thrilled she's on the show. We will go into further details. 25 minutes of extras available if you're in the Insiders Club. You can join that, comedianscomedian.com/insiders. We will talk about the material that Alison first made her feel like herself on stage, and we'll talk about the journey of her expressing her mental health honestly. We'll get into more of that stuff, but so there's sort of 25 minutes of deep dive stuff. The rest of it is just the regular deep dive, as opposed to a deep dive. This is a really excellent, honest, and sometimes painful episode. I'm very proud to bring you Alison Spittle. I never at the beginning say, any notes from you before we start? It suddenly occurred to me, because I just reffed that you were a fellow podcaster, I thought, and how do you like to begin your podcast? Is there anything?
No. You do heavy. I'm very excited by this. When I did the BBC podcast, like, most of it was during lockdown. So it was very, it all began in lockdown and stuff. So I'm very much kind of like, I'm very much used to having chats with the producer and everything and having the other person in a waiting room. And it must be very weird for the person in the waiting room because, like, you know, it's me and the co-host and the and the producer having a big chat. And it's like, oh, come in. Yeah, it's fine. You know, it's very...
Welcome into the digital environment that we've created.
I know.
We've got digital incense and what have you, and it's all a nice welcoming thing.
Yeah, we've already established our in jokes and you're just going to have to nod along or whatever.
Exactly. Well, on that subject, here's a thing I often forget to do, and I think I've remembered to do it recently to the extent that I often say at the beginning of the show of late, hey, here's a thing I forget to do. I often forget at the beginning of the show to set up how much I am reverent of my guests and who they are. For people who are listening to this who don't know you,
yes.
It's not kind of formal or formatted or anything. It's just that I often forget to say, I obviously think you're completely brilliant. That's why you're on the show. So let me have officially said that now. And I really enjoyed your Mac preview, which you were kind enough to send me the video of.
Yeah.
And like In my kind of estimation of you as a comic, I think you were going to be on ComCom years ago, and then
like four years ago,
something like that. Was it like a live one, and then the gig fell through?
Act of God. There was a storm.
That was it. Well remembered. Yes, and so I knew you were brilliant at the time, and since then I've seen you. It's that exciting thing of when I see someone be even better than I knew they were. I go, oh, this is great. We gigged together recently. You were hosting at 21 Soho.
Yes,
and you were
fantastic in a way that I thought, oh my God, this is like, I don't think I'd seen you with those kind of chops before.
Yeah.
I knew you were a good writer. I knew you were a good comic, but I kind of saw you tell a story. It was the cock blocking material.
All right.
You were doing that stuff whilst bouncing a room full of people up and down and just having that real kind of mastery of the room. And then I saw your Mac preview, which I believe Nish Kumar was at, because all five of his very recognisable laughs. I was like, I was hooting at the same stuff as him. We were in the same rhythm. And I was like, it's got to be Nish. It's got to be Nish. And it's such a good show. How do you feel? Let's zero in on that, because that is that the show that's going to Edinburgh, presumably, this year. And what's it called?
It's called Wet. It's called Wet.
Oh, of course. And so you've been doing previews called Wet.
Wipe.
Whip with an E on the end. Yeah, lovely.
It reads better than it says, but yeah.
One of the things I loved about that show is it is... You sort of don't notice at the time, but it's just two or three long stories.
Yes.
I say just, but do you know what I mean? I kind of really respect that as a comic. Like, I've seen you do kind of gear before, but this is, the gear is really neatly meshed into the stories. So tell me where you are with it. How ready does that show feel to you? And what do you think it still needs? And, you know, where are you at the moment going with Edinburgh on the horizon?
Well, like, if you'd have asked me straight after Mac, I would have been like, oh, it's great. It's fine. I tell you my worries and stuff like that. And like, it's the first show I've ever done living in Britain. And in Ireland, there is no system for doing hour-long shows, even though there's amazing comedians and stuff like that. But I've done shows before, and I think I've worked more on this show than I've worked on all of the other shows combined. And I thought I'd worked hard on the other shows before. But it's actually... when you have the opportunity to be on the circuit to preview stuff, and when the whole calendar and when everyone around you is working towards that one thing, you know, all your colleagues and everything like that, like, it's an everyday conversation, sir, about Edinburgh. It's definitely different for me this time. And it's very, I wanted to do this show before lockdown, and it was because I have this weird thing of I'm a person that when I first started doing comedy, I kind of was very young, and I'm a little fat short girl who like would have to get ID'd all the time to buy my, you know, fags and stuff when I smoked, and I think I got a lot of comedy from saying really dark things because I liked Monkey Dust and all that stuff when I was younger. And now I'm older, and I've kind of got that out of my system. And with the shows, I was just like, oh, I got 50 minutes of material. Here it is. And with this show, I thought, I went back to a tweet that went semi-viral in Ireland. When I mean semi-viral, like 100 people liked it. And I was like, I've never used that in stand-up before. And it was about seeing two women fight each other in aqua aerobics. And I thought, well, that's such a mad situation. And surely there must be so much that I can do on that. And then, you know, the more you develop the show, the less and less that story became part of the show. But I had written all the blurbs to be about aqua aerobics.
Ah, so, yeah, of course. I'm only remembering the blurb just now. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So I'm at a bit of a crossroads now at the moment. And it's like, because I have a director and I've been talking to other people, other directors and other, like my boyfriend is, he's a director. Like he directed like my play and stuff, and the reason why he doesn't direct my shows is because we're boyfriend and girlfriend, and you can't really take notes off someone you have sex with. Like, it's not I will withhold if you know if so I have an official like lady I go to, Lois Walsh, with a whiteboard, and we work on it each week. But it's just, I'm at a kind of crossroads with it because I'm like, I wanted to talk about loads of stuff in it, and then I realised the coil bit, there's a bit about the coil in it. I don't think this is spoiling anything for anyone. And that is like 25 minutes at this stage, and I really like it, and I think it's really funny, and I think it can fit in generally with what I want to talk about, which is like advocating for my own comfort, I think is essentially what the show is about. I thought it was about violence and PTSD, because I have those. not well, you know, it's very, I'm going through therapy at the moment, Stu, for like CPTSD, which is complex PTSD. And the kind of therapy they give you is that you have to go through the traumatic memory again and again and again. And you're looking for a different perspective. And it's always like, and essentially what happened is he got out of it alive or whatever. And like, I realized what I've been traumatized by was stuff that I've done stand up about in the past. And so I'm going through therapy, talking to this, my therapist going, and this happened. And then in another part of my brain is going, and the punchline goes here. And this is the setup, but it's actually like a real story. And so I've been trying to approach my show differently this time. And also, I think a big thing for me is like, I go, oh, I grew up in quite a, like a, I've had a life. Do you know what I mean? So like, I find that I tell people stuff and they're like, no, Alison, that's bad. You know? And I'm like, no, is that not what everyone does all the time? And they're like, no, that was assault, Alison. I'm like, okay. Like, you know, so like, it's been a journey of like doing stand up and also trying to make myself well, not through stand up. I think I thought I could before, but I think I've finally accepted that that isn't a thing.
Yes.
Know?
Okay. So with just to hover as much as it's useful for you to do so on the kind of PTSD thing at the moment, I have a little experience of the kind of the therapy, as you said, it's almost like reframing the event, thinking your way back through the traumatic event and putting yourself on the outside of it, observing it and reminding yourself, yes, that bad thing did happen. And what happened was everything was all right in the end, and trying to reinforce that. And I'm interested just sort of kind of conceptually, I suppose, I'm interested in whether there is a relationship between that and re-describing an event for the stage. Because that doesn't sound a million miles away from doing comedy about a thing. And I'm pretty sure I have. I mean, it's absolutely not the same, but I think there might be parallels, because I think I often write shows about problems that I have, and afterwards they feel less of a problem because I've spoken about it. And, you know, I've almost done that thing of been standing there looking in on the situation. Now, those things, I can only think of the one. You know, I've had a very lucky life, and I haven't undergone too many traumatic things. There's a sort of big car accident when I was a kid, and that was very, very scary. And that was, but you know what I mean? There weren't any dicks involved in it. it wasn't horror. Obviously, I as a child felt horror. I worried that my family had died and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, of course.
But it was kind of, there was no sleaze in it. So it's a very different type of thing to, I imagine, a lot of the trauma that people process. Mm. But it did strike me that there is a parallel between kind of standing outside and reliving and describing and what stand-up is.
Yeah, I think there is parallels between that. And I think, like, so my relationship with therapy is like, when I was 13 years old, and I think I've said this loads of times, I actually did it in stand-up. It was like one of my first, I think it was like one of my first hours or the second hour, was that I just was in the kitchen with my mum, and she had a potato, and I think the potato fell on the ground, and I had some sort of episode where I just like started punching this hot potato into the floor until like the it was a jacket potato, and it became like almost like a boxing glove, and I was just mashing it into the floor, and mum was like, what the hell is wrong? And I was like, I actually don't know. I turn around, and then they got me into therapy. I was very lucky because I had like a mental breakdown when the economy was booming. It was like Ireland was doing great. the Celtic Tiger was really roaring, and my school was able to afford to bring in like a specialist, and like every week I would go for German class, and I would go and do my therapy, and you know, the kids in class would be like, oh, where are you going? And I was like, well, I'm going to therapy because blah 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 this or whatever, and I never felt ashamed of it, and they weren't weird of me or anything. They were like, oh yeah, cool, whatever. And I've always kind of like had that attitude then from then on, because, and also like where I grew up is a village. The village is lovely. I have no problems. I don't know why I'm prefacing
this. This speaks volumes.
Yeah. I have no problems, very much have a lot of problems with it. But, like, you know, none that I'm, like, you know, if you're listening to this and you're from my village and you're like, is it about me? Nah, let's say no. You're fine. Maybe approach me. It'll be grand. But I did grow up in, like, the society. I grew up in a council estate in the middle of a village, and it felt almost like, it felt almost like the world in a very smaller world. Like, you just knew the way that things worked within the village. Like, you know, just like some friends weren't allowed to come to my house because of where my house was, even though my, like, it really was fine. There was really no big issues with where I lived. And the thing is, like, and I was into Morrissey and the Smiths and the Cure when I was younger. So the only thing I had in common with my local friends was smoking, and we'd smoke, and I would be as weird as I liked, and they just accepted that I was weird because they grew up with me. And I never, and when people tried to bully me, they couldn't, because I would just be like, yeah, so? Like, what's your point? You know what I mean? And it's weird that I have this weird relationship with shame, that sometimes I really don't feel shame about a lot of stuff. I feel shameless in so many ways, and then other times I feel really, really shameful about certain subjects. But it's definitely like coping mechanisms and just like growing up where I grew up and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
you're lucky to get me on my second day of my hangover. It's where I'm open.
That's particularly reflective.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's and it is dangerous, isn't it? I think the thing is, like, and I know maybe more than most in my position as the unofficial quasi-untrained psychologist to the, to the British and Irish comedy circuit, perhaps. But, it, you know, I like, it's really difficult to talk about some of these things in the paradigm of comedy without being trite. Like, obviously, comedy isn't the same thing as therapy, and sometimes when those things are taken for granted as being the same thing, that you can come a cropper. I mean, you mentioned, you talked about the potato incident in an earlier show. Do you feel like you did it justice? Did you feel like you had the gears comically at the time?
No. I've done nothing I have actually done justice. I've actually jizzed up every really good story up against the wall because of really, I really have. I'm looking at stuff, and there's stuff that I've done in other years that could give real good context to what I want to talk about now. Like, you know, in this show now, and I'm like, I can't do that because I did it in that show. And it's really frustrating once I've moved here. It's not like I'm saying, I think there are better comedians in Ireland than there are in the UK, so I'm not slagging off Ireland. I think, but being here, I've just, my eyes have been opened, and I'm like, Christ, you really had some bits there, Alison, that you could have made a fantastic show instead of, like, multiple shows with some good bits in it and maybe a good idea, but never. And, like, I've read reviews and, like, I really agree with them. Do you know, like, looking back, I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, it wasn't essentially that funny, or she didn't know what she was talking about. Not to, like, focus on, like, middling reviews, but they are mostly what I've got. Do you know what I mean? So, like, it's hard. And but the point, actually, I've just remembered of why I told you that I went to therapy when I was a teenager, is it was all free for me. And I couldn't, you know, I'm not, when I left school, it wasn't free. And then I wasn't well. And then I started doing comedy. And then when I started getting paid reasonably well, that's when I started, but it took years. So comedy was definitely like a plaster on top of stuff to get stuff sorted.
From what I know of you, from your material and from other interviews and stuff I've read with you, your kind of journey into comedy required a lot more resilience than most.
Oh yeah. Like, I'll tell you how I got into comedy was that I didn't have the concept of, like, enjoying stand-up or anything like that. I grew up in a rural area, and there was no comedy clubs where I was. And I remember Eddie Murphy Raw. I seen that, and I only watched that because I really like Eddie Murphy as an actor. And I was like, I'll watch this. And I saw a Tommy Tiernan DVD on mute at a house party while music was on. So I could see him moving about, but, like, I didn't really, you know, watch stand-up. And but I did watch panel shows. I liked panel shows. So there was something there. And I worked in radio. The reason why I started working in radio was that when I was about 15, I sent in a text to a radio station. They were asking stuff like, who's your favourite actor? Or who's your favourite character that's been played by multiple actors? And they were looking for like Batman and Superman and stuff like that. And I said, well, it's all soap children, because as soon as they reach puberty, like the child actor is, you know, thrown out, and then like someone of abs is brought in. And I got a phone call from that radio station. I said, do you want to come on air and talk about that? And I was like, yeah, because I've nothing. That was the most exciting thing to ever happen to me in my life. So I had to run out to the basketball court in my estate, because that's where you got phone reception. And all of my mates were in my sitting room with the radio on, listening. And then I went on the radio and I was talking. It was great. And then they rang me again. They're like, would you like to review films for us? And I was like, yeah, I'd love to. So they would send me out a check, and I would have to like bring that check to a cinema, go watch a film. And I was about, I think I was about 15 or something like that. And I had to, they were on in the, they got moved to the afternoon, and they brought me with them as their like film critic. And I left like every double maths class to go review films in the bathroom of my school. And then like a teacher after a few weeks was like, you're leaving at the same time every time, like, what's going on? And I was like, I'm reviewing films on the radio. And then she's like, you could have just said, this is not a crime or anything. I was like, okay, yeah, no problem. So I did that, and I really loved radio, and I thought I wanted to do radio. That was what I wanted to do. And I ended up getting work experience at a radio station where I had to shadow a DJ. And we got talking during the songs, and I did, you know what? I told him about, like, he asked me, why do you want to get into radio? I told him that story, and I told him about the soap thing. He's like, oh, come on and talk with me about the soap thing now after. And so I did. And then the breakfast DJ came in and knocked in and said, Alison, do you want to come in earlier tomorrow and talk to us? And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I had a meeting with them. And I thought it was because I libeled Ashley Cole on the radio. I was like really into my libel law at the time. It was like a thing in college. But they said, have you got a day off like when you're going to college? And I was like, yeah. So I went in every Friday and would go on the breakfast show. And Bernard O'Shea, who's a comedian, told me I should try doing stand up. And I was like, okay, cool. And then he said, well, I'm organising a gig, so like it's in 2 weeks. You got 2 weeks, so you can write 5 minutes. Do your best joke last, do your second best joke first, and whatever you want to do in the middle. And I was like, okay. So I wrote in my notebook, and I was like asking. I then YouTubed comedy. So I was like looking up stand-up and trying to, because I wanted to do it because the headliner was a guy called PJ Gallagher, who was on a hidden camera show at the time. And I wanted to meet him and tell my friends I'd met a man off the telly. And so I did the stand-up comedy to meet him. And I did the show, and I asked people for advice, and lots of, like, you know, I'm like 19 or 20. I think I'm 20 at the time. And you know, all these older people were like, yeah, I've seen comedy, and some guy did some paedophile and suicide jokes, and yeah, really turned the crowd. I don't like that. And for some reason, I was like, oh, well, that's what I got to do. So that was like my first joke, was like a really hack, very violent joke. And then a lot of anecdotes about my granny drinking. And that was my first gig.
And you wanted to... You wanted to do that joke specifically because you'd heard someone doing material like that hadn't gone down well, and yes, it turned the crowd. So what was that? What was that little kind of maverick instinct?
I thought I could do. Do you know what it was? I had no intention of ever continuing to do comedy. It was something that I was going to do the once. And I know that sounds like real art. I hate when people are interviewed and they're like, I didn't think anything would come of it or anything. You know what I mean? And you're like, you did. You really did. Like, let's not. But it wasn't. It was just because I was young. But I did it. And I think the maverick thing. And do you know what? I got laughs. It did get mm-hmm. laughs. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I don't know how many laughs, right? Because I left that gig thinking I was a god of comedy. And I was like, I am incredible. This is great. I'd never felt a feeling like it in my life. It felt like stronger than falling in love. It just felt like I have never felt it since. And I don't think I will. I think it's probably going to be. And it's very weird. It's very weird to know that. It's kind of very weird to know that you're never going to feel that exact same way again. But the endorphins and everything after of just doing it and not faltering or anything like that. I did get nervous directly before I was going on because I was like, because the audience made it real and they were like real people and I just didn't think of them really. Yeah. I was just, because I was so in love with radio. That was my ambition. I just wanted to do radio. This was like a challenge for content for radio. It wasn't like, you know, so it's like when someone from Blue Peter abseils. It's like they're not doing it because they love abseiling. They're doing it for Blue Peter. And that was me. I saw it as abseiling in a way. But the feeling I got from it was just nothing ever will stand up to it in any way.
And was that the reason for the change then? Because presumably along the way you went, did you think to yourself, stand-up is actually better than radio, or not? Yes. I mean, is it still a parallel for you?
I think I had, like, so my mum was very good. I'm very privileged. My mum would give me lifts to go to places. But I was working for that radio station for, like, 2.5 years for free. You know, constantly on work experience. They were very nice. They would, like, get me, like, a Christmas. I remember one time I got, like, a little sneaky check because I was on the dole. And they got me, like, a Christmas bonus. And I bought a scooter out of that. And then I crashed the scooter into a wall because I always wanted to, like, drive and independence and stuff. But eventually, I was offered, like, a little job doing part-time radio work in Dublin. And they told me, you have to move up to Dublin. So I moved up. And it was very, very cheap rent. The person that's, like, most responsible for me being where I am or doing comedy is Philip, my landlord at the time, who charged €250 to live in a box room in Dublin, which was incredible. Like, if I ever meet that man again, I really want to thank him. Yeah. Because it was like the rent I was able to afford to be on the dole or be up on part-time work and pursue comedy. And I moved up to pursue radio, but I wasn't getting as much work as I needed. So I just started pursuing comedy at night time anyway, and it just, comedy paid me quicker than radio did, so I just stuck with comedy then.
What quality do you think it was that those people on radio recognised you had, or thought there's something Alison's got that is why we'll invite her on this and on this and on this?
I'm a mad bastard, like, and that is I am, and that's been my identity. That's been the thing that's protected me since I was a kid. Like, you cannot mess with someone who wears blue tights. You cannot, they will, you know, you cannot demean me in any way. I will destroy you. Genuinely, I think it is being a mad bastard. I am the mad bastard in my village. I am the mad bastard in my friend group, school, everything. And I think comedy to a degree. I think that is it.
And what? Let's stay with that for a bit,
yeah,
please.
Yeah.
What is it? Where does it come from? How does it manifest? Is it a defence mechanism of some sort? Is it like a sort of a heroic thing for you? Like, what is it?
It's probably a defence mechanism. Do you know what? I'll tell you this story. And it's like, it's a bit grim, but it's my first brush with comedy, really. It's like, when I was about 8, so I moved to Ireland with an English accent, which was a very big no-no. It wasn't the troubles, but it was something that I made a choice when I was a kid to get an Irish accent very quick. And like, and also assimilate as quick as I could within the culture. My mum is Irish, and like, so I made a big choice about that. The only thing that I really kept from the UK was a love of two-step garage, which didn't really become big in Ireland. A disgrace. Like, so I remember I used to do when I moved, I moved around a lot when I was a kid, from like Germany to the UK to Ireland and everything, like back and forth for ages. My dad was a builder. And when I was a young kid, I'd no mates that were my age. They were all adults. So I would have adult conversations with people, or I would just have no conversations. It was just the way it was. And then when I moved to this estate, my dad had a car crash. So we just knew we were staying like in this estate, you know, it was going to be the place where we put down our roots. Like, so like, I remember because I'd moved so much, I kind of got a shorthand of how to make friends quickly, because there was just no point. By the time I would make friends, I would move away again. So I really needed to get it in and get it done quick. And I realized being funny was a easy way to do that, so I would be as funny as possible. Also on my estate, like the lads would beat up the girls, no problem. It was like a very equal society within that, so I had to be really good with my mouth, because like it was just the way. And I remember once there was this guy and he was cycling on a bike, and we were kind of enemies. I don't know, we were kids. And I sang a song, and I go, the Offspring, Pretty Fly for a White Guy was big at the time. And I go, Pretty Fly for a Shite Guy. And he stopped his bike and he goes, what did you say? And I was like, and I started to run away. But he pushed me with a force that like my face hit the concrete. My teeth flew out. I had no teeth, right? And like my mum was going mad, like with his dad, and going like, this child's been injured. And the dad was like, well, what did she say? And then the boy recited the song, and then he was like, see? And he was like, so I was like, that is cancel culture in comedy, and that is, you know, that's true. My freedom of speech was curtailed that day. yeah, so I realised the power of jokes as well. So
the
I knew
the power of jokes in that context was it got you hit.
Yeah, it did. It did. But it's definitely saved me. It's definitely I definitely have got out of lots of scrapes through joking and stuff. And also going, this is silly. You know, like, I remember these girls. My friend gave someone a blowjob. This is years ago. And like, he was a boyfriend of someone. And the girls were like, from another town.
Yeah.
And the girls came up to us in a disco. It was like, your friends, like, you know, stolen my mate's boyfriend. And I was like, lads, it's a blowjob. Like, why are we fighting over a blowjob? You know? And they were like, actually, yeah. And it was kind of, we didn't fight. It was nice. So yeah, I've definitely utilized it. In ways,
So this is Alison. She's just one of those people who is just like, she just has a shining light inside her as a comic and as a person. And I'm so thrilled to have her on the show. We'll get much more into this conversation, and you will continue, I imagine, to be furious that she has had to undergo quite so many hardships. And she's one of those things. I hope I'm not talking out of turn. She's one of those things. What a terrible sentence. This raises one of those issues. And I hope I'm not talking out of turn here. I will bring a sort of wider focus on this away from simply Alison. But understanding the sorts of things that she has been through as a newer comic, as a woman on the comedy circuit, and getting a sense of those things from someone who is so fearless and so candid as Alison, who's able to make amazing comedy out of them on stage, but also has really, really underwent some really shitty things in real life. It does make me think, as it should, that how many other people are there out there who've undergone such shitty things, who don't have the outlet to talk to them as Alison does, who haven't yet found the strength or the, I don't even like to say it's about strength and courage and bravery. Alison has all of those things, but I don't think if you decide not to talk about the shitty things that happens to you, that means you're in any way devoid of strength, courage, bravery, and all those positive qualities. My point is simply this, and I know that the audience of this show skews male, less than you might imagine, actually, which is always quite satisfying, but let's just take a minute to think about how infrequently I certainly, let's talk about my experience, I hear about these sorts of things on the comedy circuit from time to time. I'm not often in dressing rooms anymore. I'm not really in any kind of comics WhatsApp groups, which I believe are a huge thing about which I'm on the outside. I don't really have my ear to the ground of comedy, and I still hear about some horrible, horrible things happening in the comedy industry, which is an industry in which people are vulnerable. And, you know, the worst I had to put up with, among the worst things I've had to put up with, is a sort of general sense that in the early days of your comedy career, people patronise you, talk down to you, and sort of exploit you because they are aware that you, that as new comics, you are very often kind of flaring with need. You need stage time. You're desperate for stage time. You'll kind of put up with a lot of sort of patronising and, you know, people who are kind of lording it over you because they're a little way into the industry. And so, you know, treat you like shit, basically. That's the worst of it that in regard to that I've ever had to put up with. Imagine for a moment just the volume. Look, I'm not telling you anything new here. This is all obvious. But when you talk to someone as fearless as Alison, it really brings it home to me just how rich. It's like a predator-rich environment. Do you know what I mean? Because it's full of, in the same way that kind of predators after clubs, you know, club nights out and what have you, they look for vulnerable people. People in comedy make themselves vulnerable in the early part of their careers, for sure. So you can get away with some genuinely atrocious behaviour. And I individually, and you individually, I'm sure, can't do anything about that whole problem, but we can keep having conversations about it, allowing ourselves to feel uncomfortable. It's much easier and more comfortable not to have conversations about it, and keep listening and keep believing women. All right? I mean, come on, obviously, but I was so shocked to hear about some of the things, and we talked a bit off mic as well, about some of the horrible things that go on in comedy, about which I have had the absolute privilege of remaining not completely ignorant of, but sort of largely untouched by. And then you sort of just try and put yourself in the shoes of a female comic, and just to recognise the need for WhatsApp groups and kind of underground networks where people warn each other about male comics and male promoters. Just, I'm so lucky, so privileged that I have never had to go through that myself, much of that. So let's all keep listening, please. Thank you. I mean, it would be gauche to go from that to talking about extra material, but if you are getting lots out of this conversation and you would like to hear more from Alison, then there is extra material available where you would normally expect to find it. We'll get straight back into the conversation, but you can follow Alison Spittle at Alison Spittle on Instagram and Twitter. You can download her Wheel of Misfortune podcast. We'll talk about that in a little while as well. Go to alisonspittle.com and you can see Wet at the Edinburgh Fringe. So, I mean, I can tell you this now. It's tickets.edfringe.com/what-on/Alison-Spittle-wet. But chances are you'll Google it, and I think that's probably easier. So with all of that in mind, cannot recommend this show enough. It made me howl with laughter. Let's get back to Alison Spittle.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I realised that, like, I love doing stand-up comedy because it gives me, like, a sense of power, and I think my favourite way to talk about things is, like, through stand-up comedy. Do you know what I mean? Like, anything. It's like, when I talk about it, it's a conversation I'm having where people are listening, and I get to, you know, think about what I'm saying and what I'm doing. And also it's probably, I don't know, because when you're writing articles or when you're doing other stuff, you're like, oh, you have to do it within the form. And to be a good writer, article-wise, you have to have good grammar and make succinct points and stuff. And with the stand-up that I do, it's like, I just like, you know, saying what I like to say and remembering to do jokes.
Yeah, because you have to. It's less. I mean, there is craft and form in stand up, but also the most important thing is that you mean it. I think.
Yeah.
Or I mean, I don't know. I don't know whether that's, we could pontificate as to whether that's more or less important than that they laugh. I guess the laughing is really important as well. But
you can't argue with that.
But I think you really have to mean it. I had a good friend of mine, Jay, was my tech for a couple of years at Edinburgh, and we had this arrangement whereby they would take on, you know, you have like a person Friday at Edinburgh if you're doing a free fringe show to kind of be your micro tour manager and everything. And the most important thing that Jay did for me, as well as running the show in an excellent way, was we had this arrangement whereby they would come and say, before I went on, they'd just pop their head backstage and just go, just remember to mean it. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's so good. And I would walk on and mean it, because that's the most important thing. Certainly for me, it was very easy for me to kind of end up just wanting to please them. I think that's one of the biggest hurdles I have, is a sort of desperate need to please them.
Oh, me too. Like with comedy, especially when I'm talking about stuff, it's weird that I feel compelled to talk about stuff that scares me or I'm affected by. But I'm also compelled to tell people, I'm also compelled to do comedy about that type of thing while also trying to please people. Yeah. So it's very weird. It can be a weird mishmash sometimes of just what is the point of it if I'm saying something uncomfortable while being afraid of giving people discomfort and trying to, like, it feels like I've a gun with a shield turned inwards towards, so it's not going to help anyone, really. It's
describe that gun again. You've got a gun with a I want to visualise this because I like it.
Like a gun with a shield at the tip of it. So I shoot the gun, but the bullet just goes back into the gun and hasn't affected anything in any way.
Yeah, right. Okay.
You know?
Oh,
I don't know. It's not the best analogy.
I was visualising a shield with a gun pointing out of it. I think that would seem good.
That would be great, wouldn't it?
Well, would it? Because you'd be great, but you'd be a monster. You'd become a monster.
That's true. There's too many comedians like that at the moment. Yeah. When they're like, why are these people hurt?
So, something that I was alluding to earlier on is that from the content of some of your material that I've seen, particularly this the show you did at Mac, is that I know you've been treated very poorly in comedy. Like, you talk on stage about a specific kind of incident.
Yeah, I do. I think it's, for me, for me as a person, okay. So it's very strange, because when I've been doing comedy a while, and I didn't understand, I don't think there are clear set out rules about how you go about doing comedy and dealing with people. And if someone was weird with me, I would just say it, because I would be like, that person's very strange, and that's very strange behavior. And when I kind of found myself, you know, I started comedy when I was 21, and I was fresh out of, like, I'd never been to a comedy club. I was a baby. I look back at myself and I was like, you were a very naive young woman. And I've had these, like, experiences with different people within comedy. I'd say about, like, I could count it on one hand, so it's not even that big. And I think, you know, I've been going at it a while, that I don't think it's I know I'm qualifying this, aren't I? Everyone always qualifies stuff by going, you know, stuff happened to me, but not as much as other people or whatever. I love doing comedy. It's my favourite thing to do. Sometimes I complain about it, but it's only like 1%, you know, 0.001%. It's just people hold on to that. And I know that, like, when I do interviews, with newspapers, I did an interview with a newspaper during lockdown, and June of the first lockdown, quite a lot of people got outed in Irish comedy as predators, on Twitter, and we were all stuck inside, and I just went a bit mad, and I was just so angry at, you know, what had happened to other people, and it just felt like, it felt all encompassing. That, like, I did an interview to promote my tour that was going to happen in Ireland, which I felt was going to happen that year, but of course COVID put a kibosh to it. And the interviewer asked me about abuse in comedy, and I just told her the truth. I didn't have my guard up. I just told her everything, just absolutely everything that had happened to me or that I'd heard. And you know, she couldn't even print half of it, which is, you know, totally understandable because it's quite strong libel laws. And I forgot about it. I vented and I left it, and I felt like I never even gave it a second thought. And then when I was getting my photo shoot for that interview, the photographer had Johnny Cash Hurt on as his, like, inspirational song, and asked me to hold my hand up to my chin, and I'm like, what did I say in that interview? Like, it must have been grim. Like, I didn't.
Jeez, because that's the music they've chosen to accompany. Like, they've read the interview. This is quite smart work, in a way, from the photographer. They've read the interview and chosen some music to get you into the spirit of the interview. Sort of quite smart work. Arguably a bit of a, like, you should check with someone before you do that to them.
I was like, oh God, I have to promote my tour. And it's like, and they're picking depressing songs. It felt like a photo shoot of someone who had got, like, only 3 Monster Munch in a packet of multi-pack crisps, and they were disappointed by it. And the local paper takes a picture of them looking sad beside that Monster Munch. So it was like that. So I did. So I have been, like, outspoken a bit about it, and then I kind of retreated because I was outspoken about it, people would approach me and talk to me about it, and other people have been fantastic and trying to set up workshops and stuff and doing something practical, because it feels like a problem with no practical solution to it, you know. And it feels like, and also, I don't want to be a person that goes, you have to behave yourself to other people. I feel that, like, it's definitely changed some people's attitudes towards me, and I don't blame them, and it feels very weird in that respect. So I realized that the only way that I can fully communicate about stuff that I feel passionate about or whatever is through stand up. It's like when I get a lot of my stand up is about me being mentally ill, and it's so weird because I feel so free talking about it and happy. And then when an interviewer, and of course it's not, I'm not saying in any way that the photographer or the journalist or anyone is wrong in any capacity, because if you're offering that information, why would they not want to talk to you about it? But I feel, like, incredibly uncomfortable talking about, like, mental health stuff when it's, like, in an interview. But when I do stand up, I'm like, oh, blah blah blah, I'm like this, and I feel free when I do it. And I realise, like, I think I've realised that I should just talk to my therapist, do stand up comedy, and I'm happy to talk about it with you in interviews and stuff. But it's so weird, my comfort levels. Yeah. I've fully realised, like, why I like comedy.
There's something about that, isn't there? I wonder if part of it is simply that the game of stand-up comedy is like trying to make people laugh, you know, like trying to tell the truth, trying to be yourself, trying to make people laugh, if that is the kind of comedy one's into, one practices. It's almost like because there is the mission of they have to laugh, it takes you out of yourself and lets you kind of take a step back from the stuff you're going through and be able to process it differently. It seems like it's a very different, of course, it seems obvious to say, it's a very different situation talking honestly about your mental health to a therapist as it is to a friend, as it is to an audience, because the audience, the fact of them jolts you out of it into a sort of, I'm now going to use my stand-up skills, which I've honed over the years to enable me to say things and chop them up and frame them for maximum comic effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Dramatize them, if you like. You're making those decisions in the moment. But you're doing that with your real life and maybe stuff that you haven't finished processing yet.
Oh, every show I've done, definitely including this show, I am talking about stuff that I haven't processed yet. But maybe it's not healthy or whatever, but when I've processed it, I don't find the urge to write about it.
Yeah.
Because it's been processed and it's done and it's a finished product or whatever. When I do stand up about it, I've got curiosity about why I feel this way, or is this normal or whatever. So when I do stand up about it, God, I can feel it in my chest how much I love stand up. Like, just talking about, it's the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. Like, swear to God, it's brilliant. That's very sincere.
Yeah. Helen Bauer will be sitting at home listening to this going, no, stop being sincere.
I know. And it's weird because, like, I hate sincerity in other people, but I can't help but be sincere myself.
Well, there we go. It's a cage that we're all in. I mean, one of the issues with working out stuff on stage, working through stuff on stage, is that, you know, they say, like, in terms of like a breakup show, people sort of say, don't do the breakup show until you're over the breakup, because then you can look back and talk about the stuff. That's one school of thought. Another school of thought is be in the middle of it. You know, be in the middle of it, work it out. It's raw, it's kind of less easy to make a Netflix special of, less easy to chop it up and put it on the internet. But it is still its own, like, there is value, isn't there? The act of talking about a thing to people. You know, there is overlap. You know, not stand-up is not simply, it's a very broad church, isn't it? There's overlap between stand-up and theatre and a one-person show and a monologue and a conversation and therapy and all these other sorts of things. How do you safeguard yourself? How do you keep yourself safe whilst talking about something like this horrible perpetration, this horrible event that was perpetrated upon you by an abusive person?
It's a weird line. I think the thing I do when I approach, because I'm starting to do it in club sets now.
We're being vague about it for several reasons, but yeah.
In my new show, Wet, which was originally genuinely about aquarobics, and now there was nothing about it in that now. I'm even going to cut. I did a preview yesterday. And I was chatting to someone, they were like, why do you talk about aquarobics for 2 minutes? And I was like, because of a blurb. There's no other reason.
That's the great thing about stand-up is the problems are material. So now you've got your intro to the show. Here's why I won't be talking about aquarobics.
Yesterday I was doing I was doing 15 minutes at a night I was allowed to do new material at. And I was doing the last section of Wet, which is I want to make funnier and also make sure that I tell the story in a way that I feel okay with it, you know, because there's a lot of stuff I've done stand-up wise, like about being robbed, about being flashed and all these kind of things that definitely played on my mind that now, and you are right about the school of thought thing. It's like now I look at it and I'm like, maybe I could have done this a few years after I was over it and it would have been a better joke or whatever. But it's like, I wanted to talk about that at the time. And with this element, it's about, the story is basically about a thing that happened to me in my early days in comedy, and someone was quite inappropriate, I would say. And to do that yesterday, I went up to the audience and I was like, I don't have time for you to trust me, so I'm just gonna do this and you're just gonna have to accept it. And they did, and I felt good about that. Like, it was just like trying to get it done. And I really love how long I've been doing stand up that, like, these fears that you have about, you know, you have to do a bit really good material at the start so they trust you some old material and then get into your new material or whatever. And it felt kind of like good. But I've totally I think I forgot what question you were asking at the start there. I'll get a quick read.
I was talking about how you safeguard yourself, how you protect yourself emotionally when you are working through stuff, whether it is simply you are kind of naked and wriggling like the nerve in a tooth. You just kind of go, yes. Whoop, this is it. You're going to go through this with me as I work it out. Or yeah. whether there is a way, because you have to do this multiple times, multiple nights, whether there is a way of, and there may not be an answer to it, but whether there is a way of kind of safeguarding your emotional core as you go through some difficult stuff in the pursuit of a story, which is very funny. It's a great bit. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, it's much more than that. And I think by saying, I think when you describe it as like someone did or said something inappropriate, I mean, that's the tip of the fucking iceberg. But, we're not going to talk about necessarily the content of it so much as a horrible thing happened to you and you talk about it in a very, and you make it very funny and it's very powerful.
Mm.
Presumably the audience need to know you're okay. Or do the audience need to know you're okay? But you need to know you're okay. You can't go on and do this night after night without making sure that you're okay.
Yeah, I'll be totally honest with you. No, I haven't had any safeguards at the moment. I think that there was a thing of, I kept telling myself like years ago I've got something in my throat. I definitely am not going to It's very embarrassing. Wait there. So, no, I don't have any safeguards in. I started making money at stand up and then started paying for therapy. And I kept thinking, like, one day I'm going to be fixed and then I can just do stand up without kind of talking about traumatic things. Because, like, my podcast is about, originally it was going to call the podcast Wheel of Trauma. Like, it was, and I think a lot of my writing, everything, I wrote a play and everything has kind of been about like little nuggets of tiny bits of trauma that stick with me. Then it sticks with you long enough that you get to see jokes in it, you know, and it's like funny to me. And I remember when I was growing up and something heavy enough happened. I'm so bloody vague about stuff. Something heavy happened and in school people were asking me questions about it and I just joked and I just and it kind of deflected and made it better and people kind of like, it didn't really change my life that much because I was able to like do my own PR in a way of going, I'm not that bothered about it, so therefore you shouldn't worry about me, you know, friends or whatever. Yes. And I think I'm doing that with an audience as well of like delivering stuff that does affect me because I am talking about it and I am thinking about it a lot. But it does feel like I treat an audience almost like a larger set of friends where I go, oh, I've had a breakdown, but don't worry because, you know, I found this aspect of it really funny or that aspect of it really funny. So I think a lot of my stand-up shows have been like that before, but this one is like that but with structure. So I'm working hard on this and trying to get it ready, and I actually feel very proud of it. So it's kind of like it's been nice. I don't know. I know one show I did, I think it was like Discovers Hawaii or something. I had a big cry for the last 7 days of it. And it was essentially because I was like reliving this memory of a man in my house, like who had broken in. And like, I think it was like because the end of the run was happening. And when I would talk about it, I wouldn't feel scared because it was a performance. So I was like, the performance is bigger than the memory itself. And I think I could see the end run with Edinburgh itself, and I was like, well, this is just going to go back to a memory and not actual material. But I've been to therapy, sorting out that one. That one's great. That one's gone now. Do you know?
That one's gone now. That's great, because that is a beautifully complete circle. I thought that when you first mentioned I started to make enough money from comedy that I could afford to go to therapy. And isn't that the dream? Isn't that like the end of the movie, of the archetypal, the hero's journey of stand-up? I made enough money from stand-up, I could afford the therapy.
And genuinely, because I've been in therapy since I was 13, and I couldn't afford it when I was a young adult, and then I started doing stand up, and then you keep at it long enough you can afford to get that therapy. So yeah, it is a full journey.
Something you said earlier on, which is that idea about going back to old stories and feeling like you've used up things in previous shows where you maybe didn't have the wherewithal at the time or the experience or the tools to get the most out of them. That's curious to me, because I think I totally know what you mean, but and I've had to sort of, I suppose, I've felt the same thing, but it's interesting hearing it come out of someone else's mouth. Immediately, I'd sort of go, you can do what you want. Comedy's the one job in the world where you can do precisely what the fuck you want.
I know, and the room, it's not like I've done this to massive rooms. There've been 12 people or whatever have been in the room listening to these anecdotes, and it could give... Do you know what? If I have to make a big change to the end of the show, maybe I'll put in an old story to give the other bits context or whatever. But yeah, there are bits. So I did a bit about being robbed, and that is what I'm going to therapy for. And I changed a bit because it wasn't palatable to audiences to hear. So the man, basically, I came into my house and a man was upstairs, I was alone, and he came down. I didn't know it was him, I thought it was my landlady, but he came down with a pillowcase over his face, and he had a knife. And in the show, God, I don't talk about the knife, because I found that people did what you did there, you know what I mean? And it was essentially about, the joke was that, even though I was in this very, very scary situation, he asked me for car keys. And I babbled to him, and I was like, well, I tried to learn how to drive when I was 15, but I couldn't work the clutch. And I don't think English was his first language. So there was this communication issue between us. And, even though he was communicating by having a knife, I was trying to talk to him about my traumatic driving lesson when I was 15. And it was kind of about that. And people were like, oh, but when I just didn't mention the knife, people were a lot more accepting of it. Yes. And I get that, because it's actually sometimes I look back at stuff and I'm like, Jesus, Alison, did you have to tell him that? Or why can't you just, sometimes I do stuff and I'm like, I don't know what the line is of comfort for the audience. And I'll try and comfort them in different ways when I could just hold back bits of information would be better. And I've learned that with that show. And it would probably help me more for this show if I could give some sort of context of this is why I am the way I am. And it might help with I think if we're talking and I'm going to try and talk about the show without spoiling it for people, but it is this is the thing I've sent you, is there's a middle bit where I'm kind of talking about being young and doing something that I wasn't totally comfortable with or whatever, and it's that kind of thing of I do stuff to please people all the time, even with comedy. And I kind of wanted to talk about that. And it's just it's not a club bit. The coil bit is a club bit. I could do that outside of the show. The other bits I can't. I've done it in Ireland. I've got 20 minute slots and I do it in Ireland when I'm headlining and stuff. Because there are people that come to see me, and that's very comforting to be able to go, well, here's the bit that's not my club bit and I'm trying to make it sharper, so here you are. Mm-hmm. It is learning about storytelling, but trying to understand what deals are, what details are actually important. And also, I shite on for a long time about stuff that isn't important to the story, and it has been a big issue with my stand up. Like, I'm talking to you, and I'm saying like all of my flaws, but I do think I'm funny. So it's like
100%.
Yeah,
this is why I'm trying to get better now at the beginning of the episode of pointing out I'm having this person on the show because I consider them to be genuinely excellent. Yeah,
yeah, you
know
what
I mean? Like,
yeah,
you are very, very funny. And one of the things that was so exciting, and I didn't know if this was informed by Wheel of Misfortune or exactly what, but I felt like it was one of those gigs where you sounded surprised that it was so full, and I thought, oh, is it kind of breakthrough time for Alison Spittle? Is it like the fan base, is it one of those kind of critical mass moments where you seem to be, and with the content of the show as well, you seem to be very comfortable sharing deep stuff, making it funny, and being championed by the crowd in a way that I was like, oh, right. Or maybe it's from, you know, maybe it's from just gigging for a long time, picking up your own audience, the TV stuff, the Guilty Feminist. You know, like, there's like, your audience feels knit together now. It feels like, oh, that's an Alison Spittle audience.
Yeah.
More so than it might have. Did you, am I barking at the wrong tree there? Or is that,
you were
is
not,
that something
you were not at all. And the Wheel of Misfortune, like, the Guilty Feminist changed my life in regards to getting audiences in.
Okay.
And like, with Edinburgh, I'd be like, who's here from the Guilty Feminist? Do quick, like, you know, and people pop up their hands. It's 3/4 the crowd, like, wow. So it is like, it is brilliant. With Wheel of Misfortune, it's a smaller amount of people because it's not the massive, like, you know, juggernaut that is the Guilty Feminist, but the people that listen to Wheel of Misfortune get me better than anyone.
Yeah.
Because I think they share that kind of like feeling of like, I think Fern put it best, like, what she said. Because I think sometimes people can misunderstand, because there was like a Daily Mail article about us and it was calling us puerile and stuff. And it is, you know, there are stories about people like shitting themselves and like wiping their arse with the Game of Thrones map in like Lewisham or something at a bus stop. But it's not about how disgusting it is. It's about the grimness of it and like finding joy in that. And like, you know, I tell you like, it's weird, like with this like podcast, and it's like, I've cried earlier and stuff, but essentially I'm very happy, you know.
Yeah.
And like stories like that, and like where everything is just grim, but you get that, like, it's the cliche to say that people have the best laughs at funerals or whatever, but it is like, that is like, if I didn't find stuff funny, then like, you know, what's the point?
Yeah.
Jesus. So like, yeah, so with the podcast, it's been really, really great. And like, when me and Fern came out of lockdown and a gig we did together, and it was crazy, people were like getting like autographs and like had to make a queue, and it was so weird. I was like, Jesus, because we came together in that, because basically it was like, oh, everything is gone, like my whole Irish tour was gone. And I was like crying to Fern, and then Fern was like, oh, yeah, that's fine. And she did our old tour went. And like, we used to send each other voice notes all the time of like, I've done this, I've done that. And like, her relationship with shame is very similar to my relationship with shame. And we would make each other laugh so much that we would like, we thought we might monetize this for a podcast. And we did. And like, when Fern left, like, it was the most amicable breakup of a podcast, because she's my best friend. She is my best friend, actually, in the world. And like, the kind of like friendship I have with her was like something that I would never want to jeopardize in any way for anything. Not even a podcast on BBC Sounds. So, and you know, she's able to advocate for herself and her comfort and her, you know, it really was driving her, like, she fought about loads and stuff, and I didn't want our friendship to be the cause of something that, like, she loved doing the podcast, but she was just basically too successful, you know what I mean, and something had to give, and like, so, and that's a great reason, do you know what I mean, that's in it, like, it's like a soap exit instead of like dying in a car crash, you get a call when someone's won the lotto and has left Walford, and you're like, good for them. And like, that's essentially what happened. And like, yeah, so it's good to do it with like guests and everything. It's quite nice and they all bring something different. I'm excited. We're recording a new series like later this week and stuff, so it's pretty fun to do. And you're like, yeah, okay, we got Maisie Adam or we got Kerry Katona, and it's like, oh my god, it's gonna be great. You should get her on the podcast. She's very funny, Kerry Katona.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I know who she is, but I've no idea.
Oh, she's a lady out of... she was married to Brian McFadden, and she was out of Atomic Kitten, and she's the top lady.
Again, I sort of know what those things are, but I don't But then I think I feel quite snooty sometimes. I've sort of quite deliberately disengaged with a lot of popular culture over the course of my life because I didn't feel like I liked the people who liked it. But they might not have been. They were just the people who were around me. They might not have been representative of people generally.
I've done that for a comedian. What's his name? He's a really, really good comedian. I've laughed at his bits lately. He's dead. He's okay. Very dead. In the 90s he died and he was like a smoker. Okay. What's his name? He wore a leather jacket.
Bill Hicks.
Yes! I ignored
that took me
Bill
a ridiculous
Hicks.
Amount of time to get yeah, to. I was coming at it from a very weird way around. Yes, fair enough.
I don't know why I'm telling you like all of my comedy trauma stories, but like, so like there was this guy years ago. It was my first ever gig outside of like Dublin. It was a hotel overnight stay. The headliner, he doesn't do comedy anymore. He used to wear like a leather jacket, was really into Bill Hicks. And like I got into the car and he said, "You're really fat," from the back. And I was like, "What?" And I turned around and I was like trying to be like jokey with him. And he's like, "Sorry, I just say stuff as I see it." It was a real truth teller, this bloke. But he was a truth teller who died on his hole. He died. He was like, he was in a very rural part of Ireland. He was doing all these terrible jokes. Like he used to do this joke about like needing like two lungs for sick. I think it was a definite bite of another person's joke, but shitter. And he came up to me like, he was in like, basically, I'm that repressed, Stuart, that there was this guy who looks really like Ronnie O'Sullivan, who is my ultimate ideal man. Like, I love, if I could marry an eyebrow, I would. I love a strong eyebrow on a man. Like, it's just incredible. And this guy looked like him. And I did comedy, and like, I think we were gonna shag, I think. Like, it was definite vibes. And like, I was very inexperienced and stuff, and I thought, well, if I invite everybody up to my hotel room, everybody would eventually leave, and then like me and this guy could do stuff. But the headliner like would not leave my bedroom, and he slept in one of the beds, and like it was so funny because the Ronnie O'Sullivan guy left like a bit, cause it was like 5 a.m. and the guy tried to wake me up. He's like, Alison, the headliner, he's like, you've got a beautiful face for a fat girl. Like, I just want to tell you that. And
God.
I was like, but like, he's not a person that I like, you know, need. It's funny. It's just very, I don't want this podcast to be like that everything. I don't want to be like, and this person did me wrong, and this person did me wrong.
I don't think it comes across like that at all. I mean, all I'm thinking is like, I sort of want to. Obviously, lots of newer comics and people who might one day be comics listen to this show.
Yes, really not like that. Like, genuinely, yeah, well, I'm very unlucky. Like,
well,
it's
I don't know. I mean, I worry because I don't like. I'm not exposed to a lot of this stuff, and we hear the most awful stories because they are themselves worth telling. It's like all the bad news in the world, isn't it? You know, the bad news makes the front page. But you know, obviously, this kind of stuff happens. Is there any way, like, I often ask people, what advice would you give a younger comic? Like, what advice would you give to people listening to this and thinking, fuck, I'm not going to go near stand-up comedy? Because, like, I hear these stories and I think we should just burn it down. This is unsavable.
I think, it's definitely got way better, like, lately. And it's because more women are doing it and stuff, and more people that are not white, straight men, to be honest. Like, I'm not saying that, yeah, I think if you're a white, straight man and you take offence to that, it's not you. I'm talking about. But it's like, yeah. I think it's like getting different people to do comedy. I think I definitely was like, you know, because I was like very young when I started, and I was like very naive from the countryside and stuff, and just like, I think people thought that they could, I think people thought they could get away with it, because I think I looked like a bit of a runt of a litter, and it was like, okay, it'd be fine. So I think, like, if you're doing comedy, and you know, my advice is, if someone flashes you from the back of the room with a light, get off stage, do your best joke last, and also just do it. If being worried about what, like, about creeps in comedy, there are creeps in every aspect of society. There is no industry without creeps, I promise you. And if you let them win, if you don't do it, like, because they will be flushed out. They are like pieces of shit in milk, and it's like, we need to get more milk in so so the shit isn't noticeable, you know.
Well, it is. I mean, there is at least that kind of positive element, which is that things do feel like they're changing. Like, there are so many more female comics now. Brilliant, brilliant female comics.
Yes. And I'm not going to be involved
and shit ones, I'm sure.
Yeah, and shit ones.
And lots of shit male comics. Lots of brilliant male comics. But it does feel like so much more of an even spread now. And loads more black and minority ethnic comics.
Yes.
And it just feels like there is... It feels like we've undergone a sea change.
Totally, totally. And it's not my... And the other thing is, like, don't worry about it. Just do it. Because, like, I wasted so much of my talent and my time worrying about it. And, like, no, don't do that. Like, just continue and do it.
So what's the relationship between the mad bastard and the kind of... the vulnerability and the runt of the litter, in your words, you know, that the people's preconception that they could push you around.
Yeah.
What's that dynamic like? How do you feel more powerful or more vulnerable?
I feel more powerful because, like, I feel like I definitely, when I was younger, changed myself to, like, assimilate into society. And then I was like, no, fuck that. Like, just don't do that. Because, like, you know, the reason why I'm going through, like, PTSD therapy and stuff is to, like, you know, I've changed my life so much to facilitate my fears. And it's, like, it's definitely, like, had a negative effect. And I don't want that anymore. And I don't want to be, like, it's not helped me to be scared. It hasn't stopped bad things happening. It's just like, essentially, I just, with comedy and with life, it's like, I want to walk down the street late at night on my own and feel okay. I want to be in my house and hear a noise and go, oh, that's a mouse or something like that. Like, I want that. And I want to do comedy, and I am doing comedy, in a way that I feel safe and I feel respected. And I think I was approached and stuff in a really weird way, where I associated, like, respect with safety, I think. And, like, I can't control what people do, so I just have to keep doing it, because, like, I think it's probably Josie Long has said this, because it feels like a Josie Long saying. And if it isn't, then I invented it, and that's great. But something in the back of my head said Josie Long said this. I'm like, I won't let them take the whimsy from me. I think it's powerful to be yourself. And, like, you know, like, my mouth has gone all weird. But I'm proud of myself. I am. And, like, if I wasn't me, I'd be like, she's so cool. And, like, and, like, that's how I want to live my life, I think. Like, and I've definitely held it back.
What's the worst piece of advice anyone's ever given you?
Like,
what's a bit of comedy advice someone gave you that you now realise was completely wrong?
Oh, that women are your rivals, essentially. You know, like,
Did someone say that to you? Did they give
someone
you that
said to me, you were the best female comedian on tonight. And I did, and I think it was like the second gig I ever did. And I did essentially go to myself for the first couple of years, I want to be the best female comedian. And that really, and I didn't meet many female comedians. Like, because we weren't on the same night. It's not, no, and it's no drag on anything. It's not like I'm going, back in my day, it was terrible or whatever. You know, it's just the way it was. Yeah, so that wasn't advice, but I did take that to heart a lot. And also I got told, like, I used to really, and like with the show and how I'm starting it now, it's like about how, like, I would hold on to compliments and stuff. And I think when people give me compliments of stuff, I take that as a, well, I must make that my whole personality then. You know, if you like that thing about me, well, then I'm going to do it way more. And it's like, yeah, it's been a weird, weird road. Like, I've definitely been an asshole. I feel like if I could go back with comedy, I wouldn't feel so threatened by people and actually, like, be fine about stuff. But I think I was like a little rabid dog that was, like, looking for scraps, like, of meat, and just going, this is putrid meat, I will eat this meat, and it'll be fine. And then I would be angry with other little dogs looking for the pieces of meat as well, and bark at them.
And if you had like a friend, I was going to say, or a sister, and I suddenly remembered, yes, I saw your sister answering back to a negative review under one of your YouTube videos.
Did she?
She did. It's brilliant.
Oh my God, that's so nice.
Someone says she's not funny, and she's like, actually, she's my sister and she is funny. And I was like, that is so great.
Oh my God, because I don't look at my YouTube videos because I have like such a like... you know, because of that thing of, like, wanting to be liked or whatever. And when I did comedy, because I wasn't, like, big or anything, I would just get the reception from the crowd and I'd be like, oh, cool, yeah, I'm having a good time. And then, like, when you get up levels and stuff, you would have people commenting about you. Yeah. And, like, Jesus, like, I get a lot of shit that I ignore.
Yeah. And it's good. You're, but that's so polarizing. Nice, my sister. You're pretty polarizing. There's in the comments, not, I mean, you're not polarizing because the comments aren't worth anything. But what I mean is,
yes,
there's loads of people who are like, she's absolutely incredible. And there's loads of really horrible, vulnerable men who are railing against the idea that you have the confidence to go on stage and be funny.
Oh, man, yeah, it's so funny.
Don't
when
go
I go
near
on. Oh, my God. Thank you. Like, Jenny, and like, I know. Like, definitely, I haven't thought to look on YouTube. Like, if I want to bring down my self esteem, I do look at myself on Twitter and see, right, what people are saying. You know what I mean? But YouTube is a new, but with yeah, like, there is a thing of, like, I think I was sad about it before, but it is going to be like every time I go on television, even if, like, I think some people are angry with me because I'm fat and I go on telly, and it's like, I just like, I can't wait until... It's quite a lot of weight to get rid of before I'm acceptable for you to be on the telly, for me to be on the telly. Probably take about 2 years for me to be acceptable to whoever's tweeting about me. And I can't wait that long. And I'm really not arsed. So, you know.
But my point, the question I was going to ask when I mentioned your sister,
yes,
was if there were a younger comic or a younger version of you that you could... that you could say, right, to avoid some of the difficulties I've had, or if not avoid, yeah, them, but be better prepared for them or able to sidestep them, what would that be if you could,
oh,
if you could pass on that nugget?
I think, like, if someone is slacking you off, it really is on them, and you don't have to. I think if I, when I had people slagging me off or whatever, I would go, well, obviously there's something wrong with me, so I have to, like, change myself in order to be acceptable to that person. But, like, you know, that person is crazy. Like, why would you listen to someone who would take their time out of their day to do that? Like, they're as crazy as a person who, like, who bloody walks around with their trousers down on the street. They're both, like, weird, abnormal behaviour that you're just like, I'm not gonna, you know, I wouldn't take their... So I would say, like, you know, if someone's being a prick to you, don't listen to them. Yeah. I don't know. That's such a shitty piece of advice, isn't it? I don't know.
That's good. I like that. That's good. It's a good point. If someone's insulting you, it's more about them than you.
It really
that's
is.
That's great.
It really is, because I'm quite nice. Like, there's no reason. You know? I've programmed myself since a young age to be as unhateable as possible. So, as a defense mechanism. So why, if you choose to hate me, it really is your choice. Like, you know, I don't know. That's a bit, is that weird? It is a bit.
No, it throws up other questions that we don't have time for, but programming yourself. I know what you mean. Programming yourself to be like, I think of that in the way men dress, the way someone described men as having a uniform. And that's absolutely right. And it's designed to not present a target for ridicule or attack.
That's
what it is. Like, you know, men are vulnerable to attack in different ways and different types of attack than women a lot of the time. But I think there is a fear of being laughed at by the pack and a fear of being held up to ridicule that makes most men dress as boringly as they possibly can. And it's easy to look at men and go, oh, they're really boring, they've got no imagination, without necessarily going, oh, no, that's a tactic. That's a don't look at me, don't notice me, don't say anything about me, I don't want to be laughed at tactic.
Oh. Being laughed at is all right. Like, you should be.
I'm glad we got to that point at the end of my arguably mawkish "what about menery," which I didn't mean it to sound like.
No, genuinely, like, I care. I think I have an adversarial relationship sometimes with men on Twitter and stuff. Mm. But you know, I love one of you, and like, I have relatives that are you, and like, you are good. Essentially, it's not like
I'm absolutely not trying to speak up for the adversarial men on Twitter so much as say I relate to that idea of programming yourself to be likable or programming yourself to be acceptable.
Fuck them.
Are you happy?
No, I've cried for a majority of your podcast though. It would be hilarious if I did say honestly I think I am. I'm way happier. Like, yeah, am I happy? I mean, short answer, yeah. Long answer, not all the time. And but I'm very happy, and I'm very like, I am happy. Essentially, I am happy, and it's all right to not feel happy though. I think there's this thing of like, I feel as well as I think I didn't talk about a lot of difficult stuff as well before because, like, I didn't want to give off the impression that it was not a nice job to do, or, like, I felt like I was letting the side down and stuff. And it's like, I, like, don't doubt how much I love doing this, or, like, you know, like, I love doing it. And I only talk about that shit because I want other people to love doing it as well. Like, yeah, so I am essentially happy, I think. But can I tell you that with a straight face when I've still got like a lot of snot in my nose and stuff, you know? It's like, nah, that is hilarious. Yeah, essentially I'm happy.
Thanks, man. So that was Alison. Thank you, Alison. I really enjoyed that. And we spoke to each other for ages and ages, and I enjoyed every minute of it. I just am so grateful for Alison's time and how candid she was and how she was prepared to wrestle and wrangle with some difficult stuff in the pursuit of kind of talking about it, getting other people to talk about it. Hopefully people listening to this will be inspired by her. I know I am. So thank you to Alison. Thank you to all the usual people. Nathan Wood for producing and editing the episode. Moz, our new logger, for logging. Thank you to podcast consultant Peter Dobbing. This podcast largely exists to keep Brett Goldstein happy. And that is that. You can get extra content, 25 minutes of extras, including the importance or not of doing reps in comedy, like exercise repetition type reps. Reps of the circuit, we mean. And we'll talk about the journey of Alison expressing her mental health honestly on stage. Loads of that available if you're in the Insiders Club, plus all the usual stuff, Q&As with Nish, with Alfie, James Acaster, Fern Brady, plus the incredible Self-Help for Comedians special with Amanda Donnett, who I have not spoken to for too long, and we'll rectify that if you're listening. Amanda. Okie dokie, alisonspittle.com. Search for her show Wet at the Edinburgh Fringe. My show is going to be at the Edinburgh Fringe. It's a work in progress called A Shared Illusion. So go to the Edinburgh Fringe website and, I mean, just click through a really confusing series of buttons, or just Google Stuart Goldsmith Ed Fringe 2022. That's got to be your fastest thing. Or no, you don't even need to do that. Go to stuartgoldsmith.com. I have just recently built a button on there which jumps out of you. I don't like a pop-up button, but this one's quite schmick, and it jumps out at you. So go and be jumped out at. I mentioned the socials earlier on, Instagram and Twitter. It's at Alison Spittle. I'm at ComComPod on Twitter and at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy on Instagram and TikTok. TikTok, who are sponsoring the High Street this year. They've got some massive sponsorship deal with Edinburgh. That seems fine. So you go to stuartgoldsmith.com, find out everything else you need to. And now I'll post Amble at you shortly and I'll tell you all about Glastonbury and the Boutrosses gig. Then next week, I think we have Rhea Lena, which is brilliant. Then we have the episode. I'm not referring to Rhea as an object. Rhea Lena, which is brilliant. An interview with Rhea Lena, which is brilliant because she is brilliant. And then a superb episode as well with the fabulous Sean McLaughlin, which is good, which is a good comedian. And then a couple more in the can to record soon. Very exciting. Goodbye, casuals. I'll post Amble at the Hardcore in just a second. Okay, so at Glastonbury, I can't not tell you about this. I'm just, my little heart swelling with pride. Boutros, as you know, is six and kind of a third, nearly a half. He writes his own jokes, and I'd love to tell you his own jokes, but maybe I'll get him to record some of his jokes and I'll put them as a special episode of the podcast. Let me know if you'd like to hear that. I'd certainly like to broadcast it. But they're not, I mean, listen, obviously I'm a father and my eyes are misted over with paternal pride, but also I just think objectively they're really good jokes. They're not just daft kiddie jokes. They are daft jokes by a six-year-old, but all three of them have got wonderful. All three. That's his entire set. And he performed it at the Blunderbuss. He got up at the this is me saying Edinburgh. He got up at Glastonbury. Bob Slayer and Lucy Hopkins were there with the wonderful Blunderbuss. And they had a little kind of talent show thing going on, very casual, just a relaxed performance outdoors. And Boutros got up and did all three of his jokes. He'd had a bit of a warm-up. I'd got him on stage on the Sunday morning on the Summerhouse stage. And thanks to everyone at Glastonbury. A bit wider context, I had a banger gig comparing the Astrolabe, which was completely full. There was like 2,000 people in there, because on the Thursday night there's music on, but none of the massive stages are open, so the theatre circus fields are just rammed. And the Thursday night, comparing to a literally packed tent for, I mean, hours. I was there from, I think, 7 till midnight. So much fun to do that. So thank you to Haggis, thanks to Mick and everyone at that stage. And also, I got to perform later that night. I got to do one of the most, I think it was one of the most impressive technical pieces of comparing I think I've ever done, where I had to walk on and tell a huge crowd of people who had been dancing to the Box 9 Light Line Band, which is kind of, if you've seen Feeding the Fish, that... This is not, I mean, I don't know if Feeding the Fish is a point of reference for most of you. They're a juggling act who got in early doors 20 years ago with synchronized light stuff on their props. And well, Box 9 are people who do something similar with drums and brass doing dance anthems. So just this huge kind of amazing musical and visual onslaught. And the place was absolutely jumping. And I had to go on as they left and everyone was like, "Gee, one more song. I had to go on and say, A, not one more song, that's over. Booed by everyone. And B, we now have to perform an incredible kind of like a semiotic gear shift and get you in the mood for a comedy hypnotist." And I managed to pull that off. I was just so on it. I managed to convert a crowd of dancing people into staying, sitting down and watching a comedy hypnotist and having a great time. That was Misty and the Sandman. Apparently, I didn't see much of them, but they were very, very good. So thank you to that lot. Then I did hours and hours at the Summerhouse stage, thanks to Ed Petrie, the regular compere of that stage, and also Jess, who stage manages it, Liam as well, and the Elves and everyone else backstage that looked after me there. That was great fun. And then the last thing I did was a set at the Cabaret stage, which was quite glorious, going on with Windsor, comparing just sensationally. He's exactly what you need on that stage. Enormous tent. And he has the skills to fill it even when there's no one there, to make it feel like a gig even when it's under-attended. Because I clashed with Diana Ross, worst luck. But before me, Les Bubb was on, amazing award-winning mime artist. It's just one of the best technical mime artists I've ever seen, and very, very funny. And then the sound went. He was a mime, so he's able to carry on, and he did so brilliantly. And thank you to everyone. I know lots of podcast listeners came to see me there. I had a lovely time. So thanks to Charlotte at the Cabaret and everyone else backstage. I think lots of of the Leicester Comedy Festival people were helping backstage there. So thanks to all of them. It was a really lovely experience. Right, that's the context. The Sunday morning at the Summer House, I got Boutros up on stage during one of my many, many links in order that he could tell his joke. And he told it really well. He did one of his original jokes. Absolutely fantastic. Went down a treat. And then later on, I think the previous day he'd done a stand-up workshop with someone. I don't know who. I wasn't there because I was working so hard. I didn't get to spend all that much time with him. Then we went to the outside circus stage where brilliant Annabelle Holland was warming up for Fail, 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 Win, which is Marky J and Loz Bikoz doing this. I'm just reffing loads and loads of stuff here. They were doing an amazing circus show. It's kind of fire and it's like a multiple, like an eight plate spinning husband and wife act, which was very like a contemporary husband and wife act when they were talking about therapy and getting along with each other. Brilliant. And before that, Annabelle was warming up, comparing, and she got a few children out of the audience, including Boutros, and got him to do his joke. And it was a joke I hadn't heard. And I just want to tell you about that moment, because that moment was me hearing what I knew was an original joke, because it made sense in a very him kind of way. It was a very wonky, funny way. I'd love to tell it to you, but I'll let him do that in his own time. I'll see if he minds me posting the video somewhere. So he told his joke, and I hooted with laughter because I was hearing it for the first time live on stage. I cannot tell you how it made me feel. Now, if you remember Ginger and Black, who are contemporaries of mine, sort of gigging, sort of a Comedy Award kind of early doors open mic gigs at the same time as me, both went on to fabulous things. They had a joke about how this kid was going to be forced to grow up and go to military accountancy school. And this is my point. I don't wish for a life in comedy, all those roads and all the heartache. I don't want that for the Boutros. He's going to military accountancy school as soon as he's old enough. But so I'm letting him get it all out of his system just now. That's how I'm framing it mentally. He did this little kind of get up and do a bit as a kind of compare thing. And then once he'd done that, he had three gigs under his belt. And then he went and did an actual gig. He did all three of his jokes. He was so brave and did this wonderful kind of six-year-old thing of like he'd sort of stand ready, kind of frozen. And then time for it, they'd pass in the mic. And then he'd do a feed line and then he'd stand frozen, kind of staring into space with his mouth half open while he waited for them to repeat the feed line. And then, you know, what do you call it, sort of thing. And then he'd do the punchline and he did that all three times. And my God, my heart. Oh, my God. It was just so, so lovely. And I should say it is impossible to end this story about how well he did without taking a leaf from the Alan Partridge audio book, the first one. I can't remember what it's called, wonderful, wonderful audiobook where he does an entire chapter on the birth of his son and then finishes it with, and then a few years later, we also had a girl and I experienced similar feelings. So I've kind of barreled into that, because obviously I'm telling you a story at length about specifically one of my children. The other one is also excellent, but as yet not a comedian. So well done, mate. Well done, Boutros. Thank you for listening, everybody. Two absolutely corking episodes. Rhea Lena and Sean McLaughlin coming up soon. And then we've got, and I'm just, because you've listened this far, I feel like I should tell you, but I'm not going to, because every time I tell you something that isn't already in the can, it goes pop for some reason. So you'll have to wish. Bye for now. Oh, and not bye for now. Come and get some Edinburgh tickets in. I've really got to start promoting it properly, which I never do. We've sold a decent amount. We need to sell more. It's only a week. The room is far too big. Please, please come and see me do new material. StuartGoldsmith.com or ComediansComedian.com both have a link on them. All right? Bye for now. For now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.